game. Learn to play the game. Whether it's who to call when a tree falls after a storm, what committee to sit on in order to get in good with your alderman, how many tickets to sell to a city function in order to make sure your streets are shoveled in the winter, or how to get your child in a magnet school. It almost begs the question, do you want to play by the rules or do you want to get in? Marge Halperin, a freelance reporter, has been through the experience of cheat and get in. Let's find the best way to do it. She's frequently heard on National Public Radio and has been heard here on Fire Radio. She also writes for Chicago Magazine, The Sun-Times, Crane, Chicago Business, among other publications. So with tongue in cheek, I present today's guest, Marge Halperin. Hi, Marge.
Hello.
Let's get down to the nitty-gritty. In Chicago, do you play by the rules or do you get it done?
Well, there are a lot of different rules, and different rules apply to different people, I think is how this all works. Depending on who you are, you have a different set of rules in Chicago. I would explain first what the magnet schools are. Everyone may not be familiar with the school system, particularly if you don't have children in the system. But even if you do, a lot of people really think in terms of sending their child to their neighborhood school. There's a school two blocks away, and that's where your child goes, and you think that's the only place for your child to go. Mm-hmm. When in fact, there are a lot of other choices. There are a lot of schools that take children from other parts of the city besides their own neighborhood. Many of those are called magnet schools. They have special programs. They were set up as part of the city's desegregation system, the alternative to what would have been forced busing.
Is this like desegregation part two, when the buses didn't work?
When they didn't want buses. Chicago, unlike Boston, never got to buses because parents are very afraid of forced busing, taking their children unwillingly to other neighborhoods where they don't live. So in Chicago, they reached this agreement in court to have magnet systems. They call it the Options for Knowledge program. What they do is they set up schools around the city that are so enticing, people want to go there. It's voluntary integration. And they make them enticing with programs, fine arts, math and science academies, dance, foreign language, scholastic academies. They give the schools special programs that parents want their children to go to, and that brings them across neighborhoods in the city. The theory was we would integrate ourselves rather than be forced to integrate. So that's what the magnet schools are. They're a special scholastic opportunity, and they're an integration tool.
How are schools selected to be magnet schools?
It's not clear exactly what criteria was used. They were set up in the late 70s by the board after they studied various schools, in part based on the neighborhood they're in because of the integration factor. They needed to bring students. They would locate them in all white or all black neighborhoods where they thought they could entice students to cross a very segregated boundary in the city. And then in part based on probably principals. This would be strictly a guess, but based on schools that wanted it for various reasons, if the principals had good connections downtown and wanted their schools to be magnet, I'm sure that some of that happened too. Mostly, we don't know what all those criteria are. That's speculation and probably not reasonable on my part, but I have my suspicions. Mm. But a lot of it was integration concerns, where they were in the city. Many of them ended up on the north side, which is concentrated white, so that they could entice black students to come to the north side. I think the thought is that it would be easier than enticing white students to come to the south side. And perhaps that's proven to be true.
Mm. How many magnet schools are there in the city, grade school and high school?
They're primarily grade school. All the high schools work this way now. All the high schools are technically magnet schools. Every year when a child is ready for high school, every spring, you apply to high schools in Chicago, based mm-hmm. just like you'd apply to colleges, based on your choice. They interview you, they're scholastic, look over your record, and high schools are all done that way. So technically magnets, you might consider only, for this conversation, only elementary schools. There are about 45. There are also many magnet programs in schools that are otherwise not entirely magnet schools. They might offer a special math program, but still be neighborhood schools. Or they might offer a program for the gifted, as Bell School does. It's not really considered a magnet school, but has a magnet program for gifted children. So there are maybe another 50 of those, maybe 100 altogether, roughly.
So then a student could be bused in for a particular course and then sent back to his original neighborhood school?
No, would still attend that school, but it's not considered the pure magnets because they take one magnet type course, but all the others are the same courses that all the other students in the school would take. Most of the population of those schools would be neighborhood children, and then other children would select that school based on one or two special programs they offer. They're just not full magnets. For instance, at one of these 45 or so magnet, I think it's 43 magnet schools, entire magnet schools, all the children there were chosen for the magnet program.
I understand.
And they have special requirements for the racial balance they must meet. The ones with just magnet programs don't meet the same racial criteria either. There, many of them are neighborhood students.
Okay, we're talking about 45 elementary schools. Do you have any idea how many elementary schools there are in Chicago?
There are, that's a good question. I ought to know that. There's a total of some 550 roughly total schools in the city, including elementary and high school. If I had to guess, I'd say about 400 of them are elementary. That's just a guess. I don't have the figure handy.
That's a
it's a small a small number of them are magnets.
Yes. So let's get on to the crunch to get everybody in the 45 elementary schools. As you have detailed, I may want to add here, in Chicago Magazine December, which comes out November 22nd, you have detailed your plight, your game plan to get your child into magnet schools. How does it work? Where do you start?
The first place you start is the Options for Knowledge Department downtown. And you call them up and tell them you'd like to apply to a magnet school. They send you a booklet that has an application on the back page that basically just asks your name, child's name, address, race, and sex. And I think that's all they ask. It used to be that to get into a magnet school, it was all up to the principal to choose the students they wanted. And over the years, a lot of parents complained that there was too much favoritism involved and that it wasn't a fair system, that you had to know somebody, that there was too much room for Chicago-style funny business. So
that's
they went
life.
To a lottery. That's life in Chicago. It doesn't have to be life, but it's life in Chicago. So 3 years ago, they went to a lottery system so that everyone was to have a fair chance of getting in. And you would apply to the number, several schools if you wished, and your application would go into the lottery. At first it was a hand-drawn lottery, and then they went to computer. In the last, I think, 2 years it's been a computer system, and the computer draws names according to race and sex. The schools are split up to have, they shoot for one-third black, white, Hispanic, and other, although I think they're required only to have 18% white, 35% white, and the rest any minority mixed together, so they can split them up. Mm-hmm. But they try to get one-third of each category because that's a more reasonable goal. So the computer picks them according to their race, and then they try and get pretty even male-female also. Mm-hmm. The problem is that this system has not run in the way that it's purported to run.
And why?
That there are a lot of other ways to get your child in, even before the lottery begins. The applications are taken December 15th through January 15th. If you want your child to go to magnet school, now's the time to call downtown and get your application. And now is also the time to start visiting the principals of the schools that you want to get in and start doing your lobbying. Principals are allowed three discretionary picks in each class.
I love the word discretionary.
5%, right, that for whatever reason they choose. If you ask why they're allowed discretionary picks, they'll tell you downtown and in the district office that sometimes there's a student who lives across the street and their mother really wants them to attend the school and it seems only fair it should be their neighborhood school. Sometimes they'll tell you they're a math academy and there's a math whiz who doesn't get picked in the lottery and really ought to be in a special math program. But when you look at the children that are chosen discretionary picks, they're chosen for lots of other reasons. My daughter was a discretionary pick. It was legal. We didn't cheat to get in. We use pull, but you're allowed to pull for those three spaces, and I was allowed to do so just like anybody else. As a reporter, I've done lots of reporting on the board, and I knew my district superintendent from other coverage I've done of the board, and when I called him, my daughter, they had moved the deadline of eligibility to November 1st that year. It used to be December. My daughter was born on November 2nd, and technically was not even eligible to begin kindergarten that year. But it was a new rule, and I didn't know that when she was three, and I started her in preschool to get her into the channel, as you do, to get ready for kindergarten. Mm-hmm. So we were stuck. She was ready to go to kindergarten, and they weren't ready to take her after all. So I first was trying to find out how to get her in to a kindergarten, even though she was a day too young. in fact, 6 hours. She was born at 6 o'clock in the morning. Oh. So I would have sped up if I'd have known the headaches it would cause me 5 years later, but I did not. So that's why I called my district superintendent. That's where you would go to find out. Everyone told me there was a readiness test she could take, and if she proved to be ready, they'd let her in anyway. So I couldn't find this test. So I called my district superintendent. He didn't know about the test either, but he said it was no problem. He could get her in. And he said, what's your neighborhood school? And it was Hamilton School. And as soon as I said that, he said, oh, you don't want her to go there. I said, no, I don't. There were a lot of rumors in the neighborhood about problems in Hamilton. Academically, it did not do well. Even safety was a question at this school then, although it's improved quite a bit. So I didn't want her to go there, and he readily didn't want her to go there either. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I can get you into a magnet. You know, let's see what we can do about it. And it was a ready offer. It doesn't even matter who said it first. I liked the idea. He liked the idea. There are these discretionary picks. And it was legal. You know, that's my one. There are a lot of things in this article that were illegal, and it's a fine line. It was legal, but it was clout, and I don't like clout. It's not something I'm proud to have done, and at the time it was a great ethical debate for me. I thought a lot about whether to do it or not, but it was my child, and I was not going to send her to a school I thought was not safe, and I could not afford private school tuition, and here was an offer, and there was a board policy that allowed the district superintendent to choose my child, and he wanted to, so I said fine.
So even if you lived next door to the magnet school your daughter ended up going to, ended up going to my English, ended up attending, she still, in one way or the other, would have had to go through a lottery, or you would have
That's
had to
right.
use your clout anyway.
That's right.
Okay.
The lottery applies supposedly to everyone, that they have no neighborhood school considerations.
Okay.
So everyone vies for those three places in each grade. It's 5% of the class every year the principal can pick. That's common. Other people who didn't have my clout that I knew at the time were doing it another way. They'd go talk to the principal. They'd promise to work hard for the PTA. They'd promise to contribute money to the PTA. They'd promise to help out in the office or to be room mothers and come to school every day and help the class. They'd promise whatever they thought they could offer to help out. If they were a lawyer, they might offer legal services. If they were a publicity firm, they might offer to make a brochure for the school. Whatever service you have, you might offer to do public service announcements on fire radio for your daughter's school.
Grease the way.
Right. Whatever service you have, you turn in. People write letters to the principal. You know, you don't know me, but you know, I love your school, and it would be so important. So the principals get this for those three spots. And pretty soon, they find so many attractive children who and families that they would like that they've got way more than the three that they're allowed to pick. So they have to figure out how else to get these children in the school. And there are ways that they do that. The lottery is not very closely monitored. The lottery procedure is very closely monitored. If you walk in while they conduct the lottery, it's very above board. But many children have been chosen before they ever put the names in the hat or into the computer. And sometimes they will pretend that these are children who are younger siblings of a child already in the school because siblings get preference and can be put in without the lottery. So they might tell you, and they have done this, might tell you, okay, your daughter Susie has an older brother John who's in the fifth grade. His teacher is Mrs. So-and-so. And when they ask you to fill out the form at the lottery office, you know, you just write all this in your form, that these are your two children with two different names, and he lives with his dad and she lives with you. They do that. Then automatically you have a sibling who gets in. There are a lot of different ways to classify the children. Perhaps your great-great-great-great-grandmother was an Indian. Well, your child's an American Indian. We have lots of spaces for American Indians. Perhaps, you know, in fact, one principal looked at me. I have dark hair and olive skin, as many Jewish people do, which is what I am. And the principal looked at me and said, aren't you maybe Hispanic? And I said, no. And she said, are you sure? Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
Why don't you play along with me, Marge?
Right, that would have been very easy, a very easy way to get in, because they have more minority positions in that particular school. So the principals find different ways to plug the children in that they want.
More tips from Marge Helfrin on how to get into the magnet school system on Special Appeal after this.
Once upon a time, almost every mother stayed home with her children. Today, millions of women work because they have to. If companies would hold a mother's job for 10 weeks after her new baby is born, it would help young families grow right. Call or write your senators and member of Congress. Tell them 10 weeks isn't too much for the future of the American family.
Welcome back to Special Appeal. We're talking with Marge Halperin about magnet schools. Marge, since your article is in Chicago Magazine, it is public domain, and I'm going to quote you, or rather quote some of the people you have listed whose children are in magnet schools. Governor Thompson, Alderman Patrick O'Connor, head of the City Council's Education Committee, various Board of Ed employees, Alderman Dorothy Tillman, Leon Finney, and it goes on and on and on. My question to you, especially with the people in a position with clout who have sent their children to magnet schools with promises of contributing to the school, whether it's time, money, services, if these same people would in turn take that enthusiasm back to their neighborhood schools and put as much interest in their neighborhood schools as they do in these magnet schools, would that not in fact be an incentive for the neighborhood schools to build up and again build the community back?
I think it is possible. Certainly there are many neighborhood schools whose problems are far more serious than this, and I won't say that all the neighborhood schools would be fine if we had these parents in them. But there are many schools that are not so far behind the magnet schools in their performance and in their sense of community. They lack only this core of dedicated families and high-achieving children. And in a sense, well, the magnets, since they were set up, were accused of skimming the children and the families, too, because the parents are a key, too. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is an impact. I have a friend who says if you want to pick a good school for your child, follow a politician's child to school and send your child there. And I think that can, with my list here and the list you cited, it proves often to be true. The Governor Thompson would not send his child to my neighborhood school, and I dare say he wouldn't send her to his neighborhood school either.
I would think he would have enough clout to change the school right there. Well, say, don't do that anymore.
That's right. What if he did send his child to the neighborhood school? What kind of school would that be today? And not the same, that's for sure.
You would think they would almost be too embarrassed to admit that they're participating in a magnet school program instead of in their the
And they are. They didn't admit it. I did. I'm the one who printed this. And in fact, I got a few calls from some of the people whose names are in here that they were very angry I was printing where their children would go to school.
Although I did not. Is this exactly something you keep secret?
No, I did not even name the specific school. There's some security reasons for not naming the actual school a child goes to. But the fact that they're in the magnet system is what is important to me, and they didn't want me to name that either.
They can't take a joke.
Embarrassed. That's right. That's right. At the same time, the wife of one of the politicians who called me upset about this article said that at a PTA meeting last year, she overheard some other parents who apparently didn't know who she was saying to her, isn't it a shame the politicians' children ruin our Iowa scores? Because they have to take the politicians' children regardless of how well they perform. And in fact, many of the other children, almost all the other children who are personally selected, are selected because they're smart. Another mother said to me, my problems would be over if I just had one smart child, then all the others could follow him in. And her children were fine, but not at the top percentile. They give the children at the age of 4 a pre-kindergarten screening test, which they call a kindergarten readiness test to see if they're ready for kindergarten. And if they're ready for the magnet program, which is often more rigorous than the neighborhood program. Many of them are strong academic programs, and not every 4-year-old is ready. They give them to the children early in the year, sometimes often 6 to 9 months before they actually will attend. And at that age, a lot happens to a child in 6 to 9 months. Also, pre-kindergarten screening has really been scoffed at in the academic world quite a bit. You don't know how, you can't judge intelligence at the age of 4. It's very difficult, but they need some mechanism, so they give these tests. Then what they do is they give the child a score, an actual number score.
At the age of 4?
At the age of 4. They say that they score them above average, below average, which I think is quite reasonable, but they also give them a number, and it's those numbers that the principal sees. The principals, by policy, are not supposed to get these numbers, but they do because they have connections at the board, and mm-hmm. they demand them, and I don't think it's very difficult. The principals get these scores, and they go over them in their offices. They might see a high score. This child is a 48. I better call them up. See what their child's about, we'd like them in our school. And they recruit based on these scores. With the help of parents who they trust in the school, insider type PTA active parents. A principal might sit in the office with a few PTA parents, go through their list of kindergarten scores, pre-kindergarten scores, and say, oh, look, you know, here's a 42, here's the child. Do you know this family? And the PTA president might say, oh, yeah, that's a neighbor of mine. She's really fun, you know, really good and active. You'd like her in the school. She'd help us out. Might say, oh, I know her. She's trouble. You know, she's a reporter. Don't put her in the school. She'd be trouble. So they go through the list and they make judgments on the parents. They call them up and they recruit them.
So we're looking for the best and the brightest at the age of four.
That's right.
Pre-kindergarten.
That's right.
Are we going to go back to pre-toddler?
They would if they could, I think.
So
that's how they decide who to fit in and who's worth cheating for. Someone told me whose daughter or child, I don't remember whether this was a male or female child, someone whose child was slid in without the lottery, before the lottery, said, I would never have got in if my child wasn't smart. And this parent offered to do a lot for the school, but that wasn't enough. The ticket was a child who would bring up the Iowa scores, which are very important to the school system. That's how Superintendent Manfred Bird judges whether he's doing a good job, and it passes all the way down to the district and to the principal. That's how a principal is told whether or not she's performing. And we're talking about Iowa scores at the magnet schools that are often a grade and a half or two grades above the national average in a city that on the whole does not perform at the national average. So this is a strong measure for the principal. I ask whether it's a strong measure if you start with the top 10%. I would guess that you and I could open a school and take the top 10% of the city's children and turn out good Iowa scores, even though we have no academic background whatsoever.
Oh, sounds like too much recruitment for me.
No, I don't want to do it. That's all right.
Let's get back to these tests. What do you ask a four-year-old?
There are tests that are drawn up by testing companies. There's one called the Yellow Brick Road test. They have different names, and they don't tell you which test they're using in any given year because they don't want the children to be prepped. Although once one child takes the test, all of her friends know what it is. They come back home and they call their parents. And, you know, I have a quote in the article from a parent who said she was told it was a good idea for her child to know the terms earlobe and ribcage. The district superintendent tells me there was a child some time ago who was screaming in the hallway because his mother told him he'd have to hop on one foot, and no one asked him, and he was hopping up and down in the hallway saying, I can do it, I can do it, and he was in tears because no one had asked him, and he was worried he wouldn't get in school because he didn't hop for the test.
Oh, poor child.
That's right. When my daughter took the test, she was very shy, and she didn't tell me, she wouldn't tell me very much about what went on. They don't let the parents go in. It's closed just with the tester and the parent. What she did tell me, basically, I think then they asked her name, address, and had her draw a picture of a person, which is a way that you judge a child's cognizance of people around them, if they know body parts and that sort of thing. As of this year, some questions I know were asked about kind of riddles. What's in your house that's rectangular shaped and cold inside? And the children would say,
okay, I know what that is. Okay.
You know, think about it a minute. You're ready. I'm sure you're ready for kindergarten. So they ask riddles like that to see if a child can figure things out. Many of the children end up knowing these questions before they go in because they have friends who already took the test, and that gives them definitely a leg up.
Does the child realize what this is all about?
That's up to the parents. It depends on what their parents tell them. It's hard to say. I just took my daughter in. I didn't prep her in any way but I probably was nervous about it. She would pick some of that up. And some parents who are very anxious might drill their kids, be sure you know this, be sure you know that, to answer every question. So I don't know. It runs the whole gamut. Some children do, some don't.
That's wild. I wonder how many children are being affected like that, especially for the very aggressive parents who might even use the school as a status symbol.
That's right. That's right. And not only status, but it saves them a lot of money. If their alternative is a private school, private school tuition, it increases every year. It might start at about $4,000 for kindergarten with something like a $2,000 building fee or registration fee. They call them different things. Mm-hmm. And then by the time they're in the upper elementary grades, it can be $8,000 a year. So it's status, but it's also a big money saver for parents. Even if they have the money, it's hard to spend that much if you don't have to. And that makes the magnet something of a private school tuition free, except that you and I and the taxpayers are paying the tuition. And when this many are hand-picked, it takes on the specter of a private school run by this small group.
I should at least be able to get a copy of the test then.
At least, you would think.
I suppose the one we've been jabbering about this in the negative vein, but I suppose it is good because it does keep children in the city school system.
Mm-hmm.
But there has got to be a way to expand this program or have it overflow so that everybody benefits from it.
That's right. It was set up, and you could see it at the beginning maybe as a stopgap. Certainly, these middle-class families and the people who offer these services to the schools, the politicians themselves and the lawyers and the active parents, whatever their occupation might be, are important for the system. We don't want them all to move to Evanston. We want them in the system, and if the magnet schools hold them there, that's good for a start. But it's not a permanent solution. It's when it's left there and institutionalized that it becomes a two-tier system and an elitist school system. And also, the magnets can, there's some, for every doctor or lawyer or politician who gets their child in, how many others are there who do not?
This is true.
So who's to say that this group deserves to get in as opposed to the group that's cut out and didn't know the right people or have the smart enough child? So it's time. There aren't enough magnet schools, and everyone deserves this education. My daughter deserves to be in the school, but so does yours. And there's a time when you have to look beyond that. And many parents do. There are a certain number who, if they don't have a very protected school, would move out of town. And that's their choice. Perhaps they'd be that route anyway, depending on the political factors or who knows what. But there are many more who will stay and who will go to a good neighborhood school, which there are plenty of.
There are definitely plenty
and,
of them.
And who will help those that are not as good as the magnets to become better and create their own sense of community without this elitism.
They just need a little more PR, but I know they're very
good. A lot of them do just need PR. And also you put them against the unrealistic standard of the magnet school.
Mm-hmm.
I have a woman that I talk to who teaches in a neighborhood school on the south side who says that her sixth graders' Iowa scores are lower than the third graders because the magnet schools skim. They look at the third grade reading scores and they take the smartest kids, and by the time this class of children reaches sixth grade, they've lost their top achievers, so their average drops considerably on the Iowa test. So these students, who otherwise it could be a very good school, and it is a good school, but their Iowa scores just don't look as good as the magnets, and how could they possibly? We're expecting entirely too much out of the neighborhood schools.
That is the truth. And this is definitely a program without a solution, a special appeal anyway. We have no conclusion to the dilemma of the magnet school, how to get in, how to stay in, what to do with the other students. But I suppose we could do a show a week for the next 5 years, and then maybe we'd come closer to an answer.
I would think so. There's one thing that I would say. If they were to make one improvement in the system based on what's read in my article, it would be to not release the children's pre-screening scores to the principals, to the parents, or to anybody else. If they need those scores as diagnostic tools, let them be that. But don't let them be competitive indicators in marking a child for the future. I think general score to place a child is wise, but the specific scores should be as private as the board claims they already are. We should not be reading these children's scores or hearing about them from other parents, and I think that would be a start to making the system more children-oriented.
Let's put you on the board. We need some fresh blood there. And they're always hiring and appointing, so I'm sure you can have your slot, just like everyone's running for mayor. You can have your chance on the board. Be sure to get the December Chicago Magazine and read Marge Halperin's article on magnet schools, her shame and her glory. If you have a solution to it, write your article and we'll get them together and compare scores.
Or at least a letter to the editor.
The controversy continues. Thank you so much, Marge, for joining me
today. Thank you.
I'm Patty Lawson, and this is 103.5. Fire. If your nonprofit organization has a special appeal, write to me at WFYR-FM, 130 East Randolph, Suite 2303, Chicago 60601. And join me again next week for another edition of Special Appeal. I'm Patty Lawson, and this is 103.5 Fire. September 18, 1989, Chicago's Hull House will celebrate the centennial of its founding by Jane Addams and Ellen Gates Starr. Over the past 100 years, Hull House has evolved from its initial intent, that of a social settlement house dedicated to helping impoverished immigrants on the Near West Side assimilate socially and economically into a new urban life. Today, Hull House is known as the organization that was the first to establish the first public playground in Chicago, the first citizenship preparation classes, the first to investigate infant mortality, truancy, and sanitation, the first to help create the first factory laws in Illinois, first with child labor laws, first probation officer, and the first model tenement code. And I haven't even begun to scratch the surface. But as Chicago has changed and the needs of its poorer citizens have shifted, Hull House has responded with new programs. Today it has over 100 different programs based in 6 community-based centers with 22 outposts that assist 40,000 people each year. So it is still as active, if not more so. Today's emphasis is on a program that was started in 1987, the Hard-to-Employ Special Project, which is an offshoot of the Chicago Jobs Council, whose executive director, Tony Preckwinkle, is my first visitor today. And the Chicago Jobs Council is an offshoot of the Research and Advocacy Department of Hull House, and its director, Ann Tseng, is my second guest. Welcome to Special Appeal.
Thank you.
I hope I got all the offshoots right. Everything is so intertwined. It's like trying to explain the third cousin twice removed on your mother's side. But
we all work together a lot.
Very good. And boy, what a party at the end of the year. The topic, the hard to employ. It is a relatively new group of people that's unique to this time in our city and country's history, both economically and historically. Something that we would not have seen at the turn of the century. What exactly, who are the hard to employ?
In the study that the Jobs Council, pilot project that the Jobs Council pursued, we looked at a population aged 22 to 45 with little work experience and a history of welfare dependency of a year or more. Our participants in that pilot project tended to be not very well educated, discouraged workers, folks who'd been dependent on welfare and who had a number of personal and economic barriers to employment, which precluded them from participating in existing programs which emphasize job placement, immediate job placement. And given their need for child care and health benefits and literacy issues and so on, were just really unrealistic for them.
What does the Hard to Employ Project propose to do to assist these people, to reduce their numbers or possibly eliminate the group altogether, eventually?
Well, the pilot project that the Chicago Jobs Council pursued involved 3 community-based organizations, Howard Area Community Center in Rogers Park, Erie Neighborhood House in Westtown, and Clarence Darrow Community Center in LeClaire Courts. And each of those agencies spent the period of 8 months. And the cornerstone of the program was development of an individual action plan prepared with a community-based worker at each of those sites. And the individual participant developed, with the assistance of the community worker, a plan that they were to pursue for the course of the pilot project. And that plan may have involved improving basic skills. It may involve participation in a training program of some kind. It may have involved assistance in finding, securing employment. But in each case, the individual prepared that plan herself or himself and then worked in stages over that 8-month period to achieve the goals of the plan.
What were the end results?
I think the fairest thing to say is that they were mixed. We found that our client population had to deal with a number of issues, and I'll cite some of them in just a minute, that made it difficult for them to move immediately into employment. And I'm talking about child care issues, I'm talking about domestic violence, I'm talking about the lack of basic skills. And those issues often needed to be dealt with before the person could move, as I said, to the step of job search. So our participants were involved often in basic skills programs, in training programs, in literacy programs. A few of them moved fairly quickly into employment and had some mixed experience there. But I think that the fairest thing to say is that they made progress in their own developmental plan over the period of the project. And as I said, in some cases that was pursuit of basic skills training or more specifically employment training, and in some cases it was attempting to secure and hold on to retain a job. But for each individual, their action plan was the program that was pursued with the community worker.
In light of this program, to get the person into the job market and off of welfare, which in some cases may be third or fourth generation, what types of jobs are there out there now that would make it worth their while to forego welfare payments?
Well, I think that's an interesting issue. As I understand it, the minimum wage employment, which is at this point $3.35 an hour, there's been no change in that despite efforts in Congress to raise the minimum wage, results in an annual salary of about $7,000 annually. And the poverty level, according to national standards, is about $8,700 for a family of three and about approximately $11,000 for a family of four. So if you're looking at a person whose own skills and training level are very modest, and what they can get in terms of immediate employment is a minimum wage job, often without health care benefits that they'll desperately need for their family, for their children in particular. It's a fairly grim employment market. One of the things that we looked at was the importance of trying to assist people to improve their basic skills, their reading levels and so on, so that the kind of jobs that they'd be able to achieve upon entry into the job market would not be necessarily those minimum wage jobs that would not allow them to support their family above the poverty level. And in particular, the disincentives for welfare recipients to accept this kind of low-wage employment is their difficulties in securing quality child care and the absence of medical coverage in many of these low-wage jobs.
Exactly. Can you give me an example of some of the jobs that you would want to head them towards? We are losing almost like a bottom level of jobs for the unskilled laborer, as it were, because of improvements in manufacturing and the emphasis on losing an entire classification of jobs. How do they hop up from what they've been doing past a minimum wage into another level of job, and what type of jobs are these? Am I saying that correctly?
Well, I think the issue is that you framed is what kinds of jobs other than minimum wage employment can people secure? And I let me go back to the education and training issue.
First, before you get into that, we're speaking of someone who possibly has not finished high school, someone who has not worked in possibly 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years, someone who has not been in a working environment to keep abreast of the changes. So we're starting from ground zero.
Well, maybe I should go back to the title of the report that we wrote on the pilot project that we did in the last year and a half. And it's called A Long-Term Investment in the Long-Term Unemployed. And I think that the way that we came to view it, if you're going to make a serious impact on the issues that face the long-term unemployed, you have to be prepared to make a long-term investment. Investment in human capital in this instance rather mm-hmm. than investment in plant and equipment, but the society has to make an investment in people and has to be willing over a period of time to try to work with folks who have some serious deficiencies in terms of perhaps work experience, in terms of literacy, of basic skills, to bring them to a point so that they can enter the job market at a level that will allow them to support themselves and their families.
Mm-hmm. So in light of what you're saying, you say it would be more economically feasible to, instead of, over the long term, continue to pay welfare program money to people, to pay them a working wage, which in fact would end up being less than a welfare payment. I think it's in the millions of dollars last year what annual welfare payments were.
Well, the figure that I have is that approximately 30% of the state of Illinois' budget in 1987 went for welfare.
30%?
And that's about, but that includes not only income maintenance programs, but also Medicare expenditures. So it's both income maintenance and medical expenditures. Of that approximately $1.1 billion, about $48 million was spent on Project Chance, which is the Illinois Department of Public Aid's employment training and placement program. So at the present time, the percentage of state dollars that goes specifically for employment training and placement programs for welfare recipients is fairly modest. And we're also talking about a federal climate in the last 8 years in particular, in which there's been a dramatic decrease in government funding for job training programs.
And in light of what happened last night with the election results, I have the feeling we're looking at 4 more years of an attitude of more or less, if I can do it, you can do it, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and be proud of yourself. But that seems more or less self-defeating if you don't have any boots to pull straps up on.
Yes, I think that's Dick Gregory's joke about it. I see people who have no shoes to pull themselves up by their bootstraps.
I only quote from the best.
Let's put it this way. Let's be positive. I would hope, you know, George Bush has said that he wants to be the education president. And I think in terms of appealing to his best instincts and to the best instincts of the Republican Party, the Republicans have always understood investment. And I think they just need to be persuaded this is an opportunity, just as education is an opportunity, employment training activity is an opportunity for them to invest in people. And I hope George Bush will be more willing than Ronald Reagan has been to make that kind of human investment.
Well, I think it's time to give the Democrats their equal shot at it. In light of the 1989 city budget, which is headed by a Democratic mayor, the mayor's department on employment and job training is the second lowest figure of all budgeted departments for 89. It's a five-figure number, and it's got to be discouraging for someone who puts as much effort into what she's doing as you to see what little you are getting back from both sides. Why would you imagine that this particular department would be budgeted so low?
I tell you, to be perfectly honest, I'm not familiar with the city budget, and I'd need to know whether it's the corporate commitment, that is, property tax and other city dollars that you're talking of, or whether you're talking about the total budget for the Mayor's Office of Employment and Training, which includes federal dollars from the Job Training Partnership Act and other federal programs. So if it is in fact true that the Mayor's Office of Employment and Training has one of the lowest levels of funding of any city departments, needless to say, the Jobs Council and our members would not be pleased to see that, and would be looking in terms of advocacy over the next several months to try to improve the resources that the Mayor's Office of Employment and Training has to do this difficult work.
The topic is the hard to employ. This is Special Appeal. We'll be back after this.
Hi, this is Casey Kasem. I'd like you to hear a new hit song that's already number one. Number one in importance to you. It's from the biggest group in America, a group that just keeps growing in popularity. Non-smokers. It's hip. Smoking's out.
What? Smoking ain't hip. In fact, it's a drag. Sucking it in's just not my bag. Smoky clothes I can do without. Whatever you're into, smoking's out. Flicking off ashes, looking like a fool. Everybody knows that smoking ain't cool. No, no, no. Look around, there's no doubt. Whatever you're into, smoking's out.
Whatever you're into, smoking's out. Whoever you are, whatever you like to do, do it without cigarettes. This is Casey Kasem on behalf of the National Cancer Institute.
Welcome back to Special Appeal. I'm Patty Lawson. Before we get back to the topic of the hard to employ with Ann Tsang and Tony Preckwinkle, I'm going to do a little commercial for Hull House. I'm going to quote directly out of one of their newsletters in light of their 100th anniversary. And it says, what is your association with Hull House? If you should know of someone who is either an alumnus of Hull House or who has friends and relatives that were associated with the settlement, write our development department or call 726-1526. We're interested in hearing how others remember Hull House and their involvement with the settlement. The phone number again is 726-1526. 1989 is going to be a big year for Hull House. Ann, it's your turn on the board. Explain to me, please, the difference in poverty of 1888 and 1988, or 1940 and 1988.
Right. Well, in order to do that, you can't just talk about poverty. You have to talk about the economy. But When Hull House first got started, we were a very rapidly expanding, industrializing society. And there were a lot of jobs. They still didn't pay well. Mm-hmm. And we were taking advantage of the immigrants. But it was a time when there was an expansion in the economy that actually did trickle down to the newcomers. And there was and with the passage of legislation to protect the workers so they were not abused, things improved for that working class population. We found now that today, in the 70s and in the 80s, that economic expansion, we've been told during this last campaign how much prosperity we all have had, doesn't reach a whole section of the working poor and the very poor. It just doesn't trickle down. And that is a significant difference. We do not have an expansion in the kinds of jobs that people with minimal skills or with barely minimal education can move into. At the turn of the century, people were illiterate, and yet they were moving into certain kinds of jobs. There's no place in the workplace any longer for the person who reads at a second and third grade reading level.
But then the requirements back then weren't as stringent as they are now, were they?
No.
For the jobs required.
That's right. And the opportunity to be upwardly mobile was mm-hmm. different once you got into the workplace. That, you know, we're speaking in sort of sweeping statements. It wasn't universally true.
But. Yeah.
And so the economy is different, and I think we have to be aware of that. And secondly, the systems in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s with that generation of new immigrants coming to our country, 30s, 40s, 50s, the system serving them, actually, if they went to eighth grade through eighth grade, they could read at an eighth grade reading level. But can you believe it? In this urban city of ours and throughout the country, we let people get out of school and have been in school for 8 years, and they're at a third grade reading level. So the systems have failed us. It's not just that individuals have not been able to take and seize the opportunity or pick themselves up by their own bootstraps. The barriers, the systems that are supposed to be helping are not effectively helping. And by the way, we should all get mad at that. Mm-hmm. It's my tax dollars that are paying for the school systems, as well as everyone else, as anyone who pays a sales tax. I think when the citizens out there begin to realize that their money is wasted when the systems are not performing, the school system, the health care system, the child care system, that's when we're going to get change. All these polls told Bush what to say, right? Or Dukakis mm-hmm. what to say. So it really has to be that we got to begin to speak up about what we don't like.
Do you feel that there is possibly an attitude of I've got mine, you get yours?
It's an attitude that's been encouraged, yes. I mean, I think selfishness was put forward as a great patriotic virtue during this last campaign. Mm-hmm. Help me and my family. I think the American people deserve better than that. My friends and the people I know, and that self-interest in a society, and that because in Chicago people are poorly educated, poorly clothed, poorly housed, it affects all of us, and it's wasteful spending. And I think our money has been spent more politically than in any intelligent way to change the situation. And probably, you know, we just really cannot ignore the fact that we live in a very racist and sexist society yet. Not everybody, but yes, that's there. And until we come to grips with recognizing that, that's real short-sighted. It harms all of us, white, black, Hispanic, if some of us are cut out of the system. They must then be supported by tax dollars. So, you know.
Oh, that's a mouthful. We could do another show just on that.
Well, that's an interesting topic for a show yet. I mean, we have to, certainly here in Chicago, we do have to come to grips with how polarized we've become racially, ethnically, and what that means and how dumb it is. Even if you don't take the moral tone, it mm-hmm. is just so dumb. In all of our self-interest.
It's so self-defeating.
Yeah, that's a good word for it.
Well, I'm two for two today. What do you think about possibly reinstating some of the programs that were in existence when FDR was president? the WPA, the CCC, why could those not be brought back, or could they, and adapted to 1988?
Well, we say they cost too much, but let me tell you, the most costly thing is what we're doing right now.
I thought so.
The most costly thing is keeping a generation and their children after that far removed from opportunity and creating a culture for this so-called hard to employ that makes it more and more difficult for them to get out. That's the most costly thing. But we do have to spend some short-term money, so it means a legislator is going to have to vote for more spending this year.
Mm-hmm.
And really believe that the people might not mind if it's for the right causes. And I think the people, the John Chancellor on one of the exit polls was saying that the people in their poll overwhelmingly were willing to spend more money on programs that specifically would help the poor and help education, and they want to spend less on defense. Well, you'd never know it from the campaign.
I was just 60%. Gonna say, who was listening?
Yeah.
So we've got the motivation, the people who are willing to direct their money towards a brighter future, as it were, to use a utopian phrase.
I think we do. I think it has to be called forth, though. I mean, when your leaders appeal to you selfishly, you're not going to have any single tax increase. When that is the appeal, it's not except for this reason or that. Then you got a problem. But I think that the American people would be willing to say, we have to end the fact that there are homeless people right over here on Michigan Avenue as soon as you go under. This is terrible. There's got to be a way to deal with it. I think most Americans feel that way.
I think so, too. And you're definitely right when you say, people get up and promise no tax hikes. But administration, I knew that when the new administration got in there, by the end of 4 years, I would be able to see changes.
Mm-hmm.
I think the American people are very generous and have been very generous in the past. And what they need to be called upon by their leaders to do is have a little faith in each other and to make, as I talked earlier, to make some investments in people. And those investments are made often in the society by the government. Investments in people that will allow them to lead more productive lives.
The project Tony talked about did work, that we saw people improving their situation through this kind of holistic program. So we do know what to do.
Mm-hmm. There's also a class that is written about, as a matter of fact, in this month's Chicago Magazine, called the working poor, those who would rather receive wages at less than they would receive if they stayed on welfare because of personal pride, and I'm sure they hope future goals. And that is, in the face of today's economic picture, shows a very strong individual, and possibly someone who could maybe assist in the projects to be used as an example for the hard to employ.
Well, To talk about that group just a little bit, I think one of the ways, speaking to the generosity of the American people and having some faith in each other, one of the things that we can do is support things like increased health insurance coverage for not only people who are on welfare, but people who work but whose jobs do not provide them with health insurance and who cannot afford to pay for health insurance for themselves and their families out of their own pocket. We can work to improve the quality of daycare that's available for working families so that parents do not have to be worried on their job about the kind of child care that their kids are receiving. I think there are a variety of ways in which we can work both with the long-term unemployed and with those who are the working poor to provide a better environment for them and their children. And I think those are the kinds of things which our leaders ought to be calling on us to support.
The vast majority, though, of both the working poor and the welfare poor do want to work. That is such a myth. I've worked in many low-income communities. The vast majority want to work outside the home. And I remember that I had real conscience problems sometimes. I sure wouldn't want to ask a woman to go to work when she has a child who's rather ill. She can't go to work. In justice to her child, she can't go
to
work.
She can't
afford. That circumstance. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many other similar circumstances.
Let me propose one more question, and then we're going to get a phone number for people to call for further information. What do you think of the possibilities, as my mind is prone to wander at times, of possibly establishing jobs so that people are weaned off of welfare, take this exact amount of money that they're spending on welfare, and apply it 100% to a job training program or an internship program so that the people are confident that they are not losing any money in the deal? Don't you think that would give them more of a motivation?
Well, right. But as long as that welfare check, if you ever watch someone trying to live on welfare, you can't get clothes to go to work where you look like other people. Mm-hmm. And so as long as there's a supplement, enough of a supplement so that people can pay money for transportation, can have a lunch, can get the few other things they need to fit into the work environment.
Child care.
Right. Then that might be fair.
And in light of all the recent mergers and buyouts and companies closing, the middle class is getting pinched too. Mm-hmm. But you're still so optimistic about what can be that let me have a phone number so that we can get everybody up and rolling and turn the country around, or at least Chicago.
So people who want to get involved or know where there are some services like those that we've been describing, or also would like to get involved in helping spread the word and advocate for these kinds of services, could call 726-1526. That's the central office of Hull House and on work hours, and someone there can try to match you up with the kind of program or the kind of campaign you'd like to become involved in.
So there is help out there. If at this point you want nothing but a few questions answered, you can still call at 726-1526. It's a start. It might be the start of something great. We have been talking with Tony Preckwinkle, who is the executive director of the Chicago Jobs Council, and Ann Tsang, who is the director of the Research and Advocacy Department of Hull House. This is Special Appeal. I am Patty Lawson. Thank you for joining me. If your nonprofit organization has a special appeal, write to me at WFYR-FM, 130 East Randolph, Suite 2303, Chicago, 60601. And join me again next week for another edition of Special Appeal. I'm Patty Lawson, and this is 103.5 Fire.